giant of limitless power at man's command. And where was it science found that giant? In the atom, a particle so infinitely small that it takes over 100 billion atoms to make up the head of a pin.
This is Out of the Basement, a podcast dedicated to radiation medicine.
This is Dr. Jason Becht, still hunkered down in the Vermont Mountain basement with my bottles of maple syrup, my flannel, and my mitten-wearing senator. And it's here. This is it. This is the moment we've all been waiting for. Episode 3, finally up to the current era that we want to talk about. And to get here, for those of you who just skipped right to this episode, we have talked about definitions in terms of framing this conversation in the context, and then the consequences over the last 10, 15 years for why people have certain fears and such strong emotions and opinions about all this. And we are going to touch on several things in this episode, including a key TM case that proves me completely right, and no one seems to know about it. And I'm only being slightly hyperbolic there, but judge for yourself. Just to recap, a license to practice medicine is not synonymous with a driver's license. Supervision levels are not speed limits. They are somewhat arbitrary things that CMS plucked from the sky back in the 90s. And obviously, I shouldn't be so glib. There are reasons for this. But the point being, supervision as it pertains to medicine, as it pertains to radiotherapy, is not a law. It's basically part of the set of parameters necessary to get paid by the government for the thing that you said you did. You want the government to pay you for this CPT code that you submitted? Okay, here are the things that we need you to do in order for us to pay you for this code. You better do all of them, because if you don't, we consider that fraud. That's not the same thing as the government saying you did good or bad medicine. That isn't even really saying anything about medicine at all. It's about getting paid by the government and making sure you play by the government's rules for how they want you to pay you for the thing. There's no police for this either. So we're not in the way that we talk about it, but at least not in the speed limit metaphor. So at this point in time, there's no Eye of Sauron for, hopefully everyone gets that reference, but Lord of the Rings. There's no universal system watching every single transaction taking place for all of doctors and all of medicine and all of America. That is nuts. Because the government, not only is that just singular thing nuts, the government also has transactions with everyone, every industry, all of them. And really, they rely on QTAM or whistleblower cases, which is when someone knows someone or something else is getting paid by the government and is allegedly not following all the parameters required for getting paid. So let's say you want to whistleblow. First, you need to contact a lawyer. Then you need to run the potential case by them. They can either move forward with you, ask you for more evidence, or say no. And always, if they say no, you can go to a different firm, because America, you can lawyer shop just like you can doctor shop. But once you have your lawyer and the firm agrees to move forward with the case with you, they take it to the government. And that's such a nebulous term. It's usually like a local state's attorney. But the government reviews the case and decides if they want a piece of that action. Even if they say no, you and your lawyer can still do the QTAM case yourselves. It's not common, but it could happen in the system. So then the whistleblower, which is the term is relator, the official legal term, you guys, the relator and the lawyers go to court against the defendant, who hopefully has their own lawyer, usually do. And the point of just broad strokes like that is I hope it's obvious how many steps and random events and subjective opinions can happen along the way. And that's extremely subjective. Every single piece of that, backing up to the very top, the rules change all the time for these parameters for getting paid by the government. Even if you want to go by nothing other than just the most crude interpretation of supervision rules for radiation in hospital outpatient departments, even that, just the most conservative sort of ham-fisted reading of those rules, those have changed at least 4 times in the last 30 years. And if you want to get more nuanced, definitely more than 4. And so just to recap what I mean by that, it was initially supervision was meant just for freestanding, and which is distinct from hospital outpatient. And those definitions can be very fluid. And just to pause on this for a second, just to really drive this home, freestanding is not synonymous with private practice. You can be hospital outpatient in private practice. You can be freestanding in academic. You could be academic and on a professional services contract billing as a 1099 contractor. You could be private practice and an employee. These terms are not what you think they are. And I just get the strong sense that people talk about these things as synonymous, and they are not. And I think that's very important. And also to realize that these things can be fluid, where you can bill 1 year as a freestanding, and the next year you can bill as a hospital outpatient department. I don't have a good read. That's obviously not broadcasted, so I don't really know how common that is, but these are not stone tablet type things. But the big one is freestanding is not synonymous with private practice. If freestanding radiation oncology disappears, that does not mean that private practice disappears. They are not the same. To revisit the definitions of supervision, the three levels of supervision, you have personal supervision, which basically means you are in the room where something is happening. You have direct supervision, which means you are not necessarily in the room, but you are, quote unquote, immediately available. And CMS has never defined that to any satisfactory sort of extent, but a Medicare contractor, Palmetto GBA, has ambitiously decided that they were going to define that this month. So we'll see how that goes. But, and then general supervision, meaning something's happening under the supervision of a physician generally, meaning that they have laid out a course of action and they are overseeing it. But general supervision has no, they don't care where you are physically. And then if you look in the fee schedules, there's 09, another quote unquote level, but it's basically just does not apply. So for the purposes of our tales here, supervision requirements were really set forth in the beginning in the late 1990s, ostensibly for freestanding. And that continued on. And then around the time of the Cures Act in 2009, they said, oh, by the way, those supervision requirements you thought only applied to freestanding, those also now apply to hospital outpatient. And oh, wait, one more thing, side note, they are backwards applicable. So we've meant this the whole time. And obviously, that's a very problematic clarification. So just imagine that you've been doing something one way for a decade because the government told you you could. And then they come out and say, oh, psych, new way. And the new way is actually the old way. Good luck. And that's pretty common for how these clarifications go. They often don't clarify at all. But, and you see this so often with these rule updates where just they hear or see that things are problematic in the way language is done. And so they issue a quote unquote clarification that you see this with like Stark and anti-kickback. And it just gets more confusing often. And usually they clarify in such a way that it's even more liability for doctors. But so that was the tale. So then, as was in episode two, we had the consequences of RADONC's focus on supervision, which tied into so many other things. You have the New York Times radiation boom series. You have the crackdown because of the SGR reports. You have the urology battle with Stark and so on and so forth. If 2000 to 2010 was an exciting high-flying time in radiation medicine, 2010 to 2020 was a hangover. Then in November of 2019, there was an unexpected announcement from CMS. Now, by unexpected, people like me. At the time, that was the start of my deep interest in these things. So I wasn't paying as close of attention as I do now, but I pay closer attention than I feel like a lot of people do because I'm a nerd. But in November of 2019, the government unexpectedly announced that they were moving all of this to general supervision in hospital outpatient departments. And so things, therapeutic procedures like radiation therapy and hoo boy. And so just remember, this was November of 2019, slated to take effect in January of 2020. So it had nothing to do with the pandemic, which, Claire, you know, becomes problematic in this whole conversation. And although maybe if you're a conspiracy theorist, this had everything to do with the pandemic. I'm just joking. Or am I? The thing to keep in mind about why this seemed unexpected is that medicine is bigger than just us. And so these problematic clarifications that we fight about were causing issues everywhere. And most notably, they created a tiered system with supervision where there is a rule of non-enforcement, meaning that when the whole direct supervision change happened in 2009, which again, no one expected. So that's why it was a problem. If people had an inkling about this or knew about this, it just came out of nowhere. Critical access to hospitals, which are 25 beds or fewer, usually in rural areas, things of that nature, said, hey, our system has been in place for X amount of years, decades. All of a sudden now you're telling us that we need to do direct supervision, and that's really problematic. It's already hard enough to recruit people, to recruit doctors to this place. If you're saying that we can't offer things unless it's under direct supervision, which is a change from how we've always done things, then you're going to hurt access to care in these more rural areas, which was true. And so the government said, hey, that is a reasonable point. And so what we're going to do is we're going to have non-enforcement. And they issued, I can't remember how they phrased it, but they issued like a advisory thing or a ruling. I can't remember. But they basically officially said, we're not going to enforce it for critical access hospitals, which is a very interesting thing to do because you've just created a tiered system. So the government is literally saying in urban environments or more populated areas, urban and suburban, you hospital outpatient departments must follow direct supervision. Now, you critical access hospitals offering the exact same services, we're just going to look the other way. We're fine with it. What a crazy thing to do, really. And that was 10 years or more, actually, because that started like almost immediately, and which really just leads you to question, what was the point? We talk about this as a safety thing, which is the reasonable way to talk about it. But the government thinks about it as a fraud thing. What is this broadcast? What messaging is this? Either this matters or it doesn't, where if you can perform, we'll keep going with radiation therapy. If the government says, if you're a critical access hospital, you can provide radiation therapy under general supervision from 2009 on. But if you do that 10 miles away in a suburban hospital, it's not a critical access hospital. It's suddenly fraud. Does that make any sense? Because it's either safe or it's not. It's either a requirement or it's not. And obviously, this caused a lot of issues. And we'll be here forever if I try to explore all the... Because that conversation, to my knowledge, wasn't really happening here in radiation medicine, that style of conversation or that concern. Because we get so caught up in our own whistleblower cases and all those things that I don't think that was really addressed. And also, there's not a lot of radiation therapy being delivered in critical access hospitals. And most of our conversations that would have this flavor have actually been tied up in the whole freestanding thing, just because the people who are in key leadership positions at the ABR and ASTR, or at least have been historically, happen to be at largest non-hospital corporation practicing radiation medicine in America, 21C Turn Genesis. And so obviously their interests are not necessarily in talking about critical access versus urban and suburban, but more around freestanding, which doesn't really apply to the majority of us. But that's a soapbox for another time. And let's go back to the announcement. And so get an email, at least I got it in an email. I think we all did, but this is where I saw it. And it was announcing the rules change. So it was November 1st, 2019, CMS published the 2020 Outpatient Prospective Payment System Final Rule. And that changed the level of physician supervision required for outpatient therapeutic services from direct to general in hospital outpatient departments, regardless of critical access hospital or not. The purpose of this change was to increase flexibility for providers rendering medical care by relieving the burden associated with direct supervision requirements. While general supervision will become the new default standard, it was important to note that certain outpatient therapeutic services may still be required to have direct or personal supervision requirements. So, the finalized rule was meant to create a more uniform approach to the level of supervision for a hospital outpatient required amongst the critical access hospitals, small rural hospitals, and hospitals that don't fall into those two categories. And previously, CMS was enforcing a two-tiered system. And I went back and I'm pulling this off a law blog. A lot of my stuff comes from these like law firm blogs, which really helpful. But although Medicare required therapeutic outpatient hospital services to be provided under the direct supervision of a physician in both the hospital and CAH setting, CMS has historically instructed all Medicare administrative contractors to not enforce the direct supervision requirements in CAHs. Upon implementation of the final rule, all hospitals may generally provide outpatient therapeutic services under general supervision without risk of non-compliance. Well, I definitely remember when this happened, and I don't want to say the world exploded, That would be hyperbolic. But this caused quite a stir. And because this has, remember, this is at the end of an era. And so it's also important, going back to many other episodes that I've done, this unexpectedly came out right as the bubble burst for radiation oncology. So this was announced on November 1st, 2019. Leading up to that, we had just come off the ADR debacle of 2018, meaning the exams. So there had been this building unrest that was a silent majority type move. Then we had the massive board exam failures of 2018, and we had the response from our leadership saying, it's not us, it's you, you're dumb. I'm paraphrasing. And that didn't go over well. And so this was when, and you can start to see this reflected in the match data. I haven't done this yet. We should go back and look. I believe that this rule was announced just as it was starting to not become clear, but there is indications that the match was probably not going to go the way that it used to go. And so this caused quite the stir. So obviously, Astro, as they like to do, issued a white paper. And let's go ahead and listen to that.
On Friday, November 1st, 2019, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services issued the 2020 Hospital Outpatient Prospective Payment System final rule, lowering the supervision level required for hospital-based therapeutic services, including radiation therapy services, from direct to general supervision. After carefully reviewing the rule and clarifying questions with the agency, the Astra Board of Directors approved this updated guidance to help members understand that the supervision changes are more limited than they appear. Most notably, direct supervision is still required, and the new general supervision policy does not apply when radiation therapy is delivered in a freestanding center. The work of radiation treatment management is performed, brachytherapy, stereotactic radiation therapy, and other services described by CPT codes, requiring that the radiation oncologist personally provide the services are performed, diagnostic services such as image guidance are performed, or a hospital determines that radiation therapy services require direct supervision.
So this was both very surprising and completely predictable, but it's interesting. The tact that Astra takes here to disagree with this or try to say that this is not a thing is one that was new. We'll get to that in a second. I just setting up the final QTM case here, I think it's important to hear this second passage. Obviously, you guys can go read the white paper. It's still on their website for now. But this is one more key part, and then we won't go through the whole thing because we'll be here for 400 days, but one other part.
In summary, the supervising physician must have, within his or her state scope of practice and hospital-granted privileges, the knowledge, skills, ability, and privileges to perform the service or procedure or provide additional orders. While it is Astro's opinion that a board-certified, board-eligible radiation oncologist is the clinically appropriate physician to supervise radiation treatments, we recognize that some flexibility is necessary for those practices that deliver care to underserved populations who may experience access to care issues.
We'll return to that opinion about who was within their scope of practice to supervise, because it is at least very clear in the wording of that passage about who should be supervising that it was an opinion. But this diagnostic test thing. So imagine my surprise when I read that. And this was the debate I thought that was going to take place. And then the pandemic hit. And I don't think it's been just such a weird series of events. But if you put yourself back at this time, November 1st, 2019, it was the start of the burst of the bubble. And it wasn't yet entirely clear. People were still very upset about the board exam failure rate. Then you have this supervision change, and APM was still looming. So this is still deep in APM time when we were very concerned about that. And the direction that I thought we were going at the time, and this is why I hate when I talk about job markets and oversupplies and whatnot. If you try to ask me what I predict the future, if you say, what do you think 2034 is going to be? I don't know. Because if you look, there's all these black swan events. Now, black swan implies maybe it was negative. And this is always, it's like black hat, white hat hackers. I don't quite understand. So I'm using black swan events to mean just random. Because if you look back through the last 30, 40 years of radiation medicine, every 10 years is punctuated with something unpredictable. And now, unfortunately, if you guys recall in the Astro Workforce Task Force paper, they banked on that. You should never bank on a random event in your modeling. And then furthermore, you shouldn't bank on it going in a certain direction. So in the Workforce Task Force model, they are banking on some new indication that's worth on average 20 WRVUs. That's insane. And we don't know, because you don't know if that's going to happen, if whatever event it is, it's a butterfly effect. You cannot know. It's emergent properties of a complex system. And if you had asked me when Astro came out with this white paper, I think it was December, it was like within a month of the rule change announcement, I did not think we were going to be where we are now because the pandemic happened. And we're staring down the barrel of APM, this fight over supervision, crash of the competitiveness, and we get 3 months into 2020 and everything goes sideways, which is why I never got to have this debate, or I felt like the field never really got to have this debate in the way that I thought we were going to, because this claim that IGRT is a diagnostic test is madness. Just on its face, say that out loud. Image-guided radiation therapy does not fall under general supervision because actually it's a diagnostic test, and diagnostic tests are still direct supervision. Ergo, if you were doing IGRT, direct supervision, no one on planet Earth prior to this would ever say that IGRT is a diagnostic test. And they make it clear, so their entire argument rests on the fact that IGRT is usually KV-KV, EMV, or cone beam CT. Basically, it uses X-rays. So that's the justification in this white paper, is that IGRT uses X-rays, and X-rays are a diagnostic test, ergo direct supervision. So let's drill down into that a little bit, shall we? So within that statement, this is the citation. This is citation number 13 from that Astro response to a white paper from the Medicare Benefit Policy Manual. So let's track this down at the beginning. So here it is.
Astro citation number 13, Medicare Benefit Policy Manual. Chapter 6, section 20.4.4, coverage of outpatient diagnostic services furnished on or after January 1, 2010. However, this guidance and the long-established regulation at 42 CFR 410.32 also state that diagnostic X-ray and other diagnostic tests must be furnished under the appropriate level of supervision by a physician, as defined in Section 1861 of the Act, and may not be supervised by non-physician practitioners.
And if you believe that, that is very clear. So there's no believing or not believing. That is what the Medicare Benefit Policy Manual says. And it is an argument that makes sense if you take it at face value, if you don't question anything else. So if you draw the straight line of logic of IGRT uses X-rays, X-rays are diagnostic, diagnostic exams have this supervision. So what this effectively does is takes away not only supervision, so it's a good attempt. And because then you also take away the whole incident too, where it says right there, it's direct supervision and you can't have a mid-level do it. But still, man, that doesn't make any sense. I wonder if Medicare actually defines what a diagnostic test is, because I could be wrong. And while it doesn't pass the sniff test, so when I think about IGRT, if I'm thinking about what is a diagnostic test, you're trying to either identify a disease or the extent of a disease. And IGRT is not doing that. IGRT is part of a therapeutic procedure, basically ensuring that a therapeutic procedure is being delivered as intended. The sniff test for me would be, if you're going to call something a diagnostic test, would you ever order it by itself? Meaning, would you ever order KV orthogs if you weren't doing radiotherapy? If somebody walked in off the street, said, "Doc, I got a cough," would any doctor or provider or anyone say, "Oh, yes, I see your cough. I'm going to order IGRT and we're going to figure this out"? No, it's not a thing. So that's my stiff test. But I wonder if Medicare says, "Oh, you know what? Maybe we should do. We should, in the same Medicare Benefit Policy Manual, same Chapter 6, same Section 20, instead of going, so Astro's referencing Section 20.4, maybe we should scroll up and go to section 20.4.1, the start of that. Let's see what Medicare says.
Medicare Benefit Policy Manual. Chapter 6, Section 20.4.1. Diagnostic services defined. A service is diagnostic if it is an examination or procedure to which the patient is subjected to obtain information to aid in the assessment of a medical condition or the identification of a disease.
That certainly doesn't sound like IGRT meets that definition. Flip that around. So for anything to be paid for by Medicare, again, going back to those parameters, it has to be medically necessary. Playing a thought experiment game here. If I were to order IGRT and I were challenged on that, so like a prior authorization or whatnot, if I put it as my justification for why I am seeking reimbursement for that, that I was using the IGRT to aid in the assessment or identification of a disease, would that be paid? No, it would not. Just cut to the chase. If I used that language as my justification, it would not be considered medically necessary. And that's why this just was so perplexing to me. And I don't, before this moment, I would love to know the backstory on where they came up with this. Because again, I don't think that I'm a broken record with this, but I don't think anyone was intentionally being deceitful here. I suspect that this was the honest assessment. So if I was putting myself, knowing everything I know about how this crew has worked over the years, I'm going to imagine that they saw the supervision change and they were advisors. They flipped open the Medicare. Because if you don't dig into this, like this actually does logically track, where it does repeatedly say basically that X-rays are a diagnostic test. It says that everywhere. And if you don't drill down further, so if you're looking for an excuse to say direct supervision is necessary and you are flipping through the Medicare benefit policy manual and you see everywhere that X-ray diagnostic test, and you pull it up, yeah, I would imagine that they found this or somebody already knew about it or pointed them in this right direction or whatnot. This supports their argument, and why would you take it that step further? Now, to me, that is weird because I want to quote Alexander Hamilton, the play there, I want to be in the room where it happened. It is interesting to just say this out loud. IGRT is a diagnostic test. It just doesn't track. Anyway, I'll get off of this point. But so that was the initial. And I believe they had ACR, like they got some other organizations to say this. And all right, if you're looking for an excuse, I get it. And we never really even got to challenge this because then the pandemic happened and we went to virtual direct supervision. So CMS ruled that during the public health emergency, direct supervision can be conducted virtually as long as there is a way to do real-time audiovisual communication, meaning something like FaceTime. If you have an iPhone and a therapist has an iPhone and you guys can FaceTime, that would be considered direct virtual supervision. So obviated the need. And oh yeah, the pesky pandemic. So this kind of gets sidelined just because of the fact that it wasn't necessary to even consider it. We only had a few months, and as anyone may recall, even by January of 2020, the pandemic was looming. We never really debated this, but I just, not to litigate the past or anything, this was so strange. And it's not even the past, because I still see this argument trotted out here and again. IGRT is not a diagnostic test. You're going to need to do, if you want to stick with that argument, you're going to need to draw a much better line. All right, we'll get to virtual direct in a minute. So the other argument that's been trotted out. Now, with this next thing I'm going to talk about, this has only been put forward that I have seen by a single coding and billing compliance agency. So I just am going to not name names or any of that. The people who are in the know who I'm talking about. So there's very few agencies dedicated to radiation-specific coding and billing. And unfortunately, there's even fewer now than there used to be. So there used to be at least three major ones that I knew about. Now it's just basically down to two, and only one really publishes books or anything. And so this agency, I took one of this agency's instructional webinars this summer, and I'm recording this at the end of 2023. And because even though, well, I made this is an important key of my life. You guys, you hear me talk about how I disagree with many things at this point of the podcast, but it is important not to build your own echo chamber. And so whether or not I agree or disagree with things, if an entity has some sort of authority or space or whatnot, if I still try to pay attention and see what they're saying, and it's the only way to learn, you can't shut things out, and you have to engage with all sides of an issue to really gain an understanding of it. At least that's just my opinion about it. In this webinar, this was brought up, this question, so it was actually quite helpful. And then plus, again, while I disagree with certain things about certain opinions in certain agencies or societies or whatnot, there is still lots of like good stuff or things that I don't disagree with, or the point being, don't build an echo chamber. So overall, the webinar on the coding building was quite interesting and good, and a lot of resources out of it. But this topic came up, and the concept about, all right, direct, general, virtual direct, people are confused because there's been a lot of confusing messaging, or it was initially pretty clear from CMS, in my opinion, and then people with agendas who are in radiation medicine, either as physicians or providers or as ancillary providers of services, got involved in the mix. They muddied the water, which I don't think CMS is too happy about, but that's something else for another time. So this topic got brought up. And for the first time, I heard the argument that they were no longer going with IGRT as a diagnostic test. That was not their argument for justifying what I'm going to call LINAC babysitting. Their justification for LINAC babysitting is that I don't even know how to phrase this easily. Basically, what they said was that, yes, because of the rule changes and whatnot, it is okay for IGRT and treatment to take place when the physician is not directly supervising, meaning if the physician is working remotely or whatnot. But if you want to bill for that, let's say you reviewed IGRT at home, that's not allowed because physician work and supervision are two very different things. Yeah, confusing. When I went into this further, they started this argument actually a couple of years ago, and I just missed it because, again, there was other things to pay attention to in the world. And so from a slide deck that they came out with in 2020, I'm just going to paraphrase here, it was proposed change and finalized changes to general supervision. This is for the HOPS, the Hospital Outpatient 2020 Supervision Changes, effective January 1st, 2020. The switch to generalized supervision, the bullet point here, sought comments whether radiation oncology and chemotherapy administration should be exempted and still require direct supervision. CMS stressed this does not prevent hospitals and physicians to set direct supervision for services. Believes this allows for provider flexibility to set supervision as appropriate and necessary, which I totally agree with. This is the crazy part. We yell at the government all the time. CMS was pretty reasonable here. So what the people who were at the agency, and again, this government, it changes over all the time. So the people who made choices back in 2009 with the supervision stuff, that was not good. But then CMS listened to feedback. And so there was that MedPAC report from 2017. They've heard from AHA. They heard all this. They heard people, right? And so they came out with this rule, and this is how it should work. So after hearing all this feedback, they changed their language. They changed their policy, saying that we're gonna set to general, meaning you can't just, so it still puts some guardrails on it. You can't just have no supervision so they put guardrails on it, but back to where it used to be. And then they say, but we're not gonna stop individual hospitals or whatnot from saying their policy is different, that they can require a higher level of supervision if they want, and that this is how government's supposed to work. This is crazy. Why would you fight this? But obviously, I know why they would fight, but good for CMS for this. And so then we all just did our thing with it. But so then in this PowerPoint presentation, and this is what they've said elsewise, is supervision is not physician work. Those are two very different things. Supervision applies to the ancillary staff work and technical bill charges. Physician personal work is still required for physician services and codes with professional components. If service is not telehealth approved code, physician physical presence is still required to bill services. Supervision is the location of the physician relative to ancillary staff working under the direction of the physician. This is a confusing argument, but let's see what they're trying to communicate here. So by making this argument, you are still saying that direct supervision is required. Now, I would be quick to point out that no Astro has never made this argument. I've never seen any other agency make this argument except for this one place. Now, unfortunately, this one place has a lot of influence, and their chairman serves as an expert witness in all these things. So there's a lot of tail wagging the dog going on here. But if you think about what is being said here, argument one, which everyone tried, was IGRT is a diagnostic test. Not only is that shenanigans, it was rendered totally irrelevant by the pandemic with virtual direct supervision. But so they tried that tact. But if you make this argument that supervision is actually totally nothing to do with anything, and it's the physician work is something separate, they're saying that if you're going to bill for IGRT, and this is actually expanding on things, but if you do work at home, and because that's the easiest example. So the easiest example is, let's say you have a full load of patients, you get through the day, and you go home and you do the IGRT, the offline review at night. You go through and review those images. What this argument says is if you do that and you bill for it, you're committing fraud because it's not a telehealth approved code and you're billing the professional component at a different location. I'm not sure if I'm making that more clear. I hope people get what I'm saying, because this is crazy. And it defeats also virtual direct. That's what this does. This is like the ultimate trump card attempt here, where if you make this argument, you're saying that it doesn't matter about virtual direct. No, virtual direct is just about supervision. Supervision is not about professional charges. And you better be on site if you're going to bill for something, because if you're not on site, committing fraud. Now, when I first heard this, just like with the diagnostic, I was very confused, because there's many, many specialties which have remote setups. There's tele-ICU, there's tele-stroke, those sorts of things. But there's teleradiology. So teleradiology is by far the most applicable. And that's what I first thought of, because they tried this diagnostic thing a couple of years back. But if this statement is true, then they are saying the entire industry of teleradiology is fraud. I said, that doesn't sound right. I'm going to go look into that. And back in 2013, Medicare addressed this with transmittal. Let's see what that says.
This instruction establishes that for all services paid under the MPFS, that the POS code to be used by the physician and other supplier shall be assigned as the same setting in which the beneficiary received the face-to-face service. In cases where the face-to-face requirement is obviated, such as those when a physician provides the professional component, as in interpretation, of a diagnostic test, from a distant site, the POS code assigned by the physician shall be the setting in which the beneficiary received the technical component service.
Now, as always, I don't know if this agency was aware of, this is transmittal 2679, as before, and this took me a while to find, because to invoke that argument, it, as the other one did, it passes a sniff test if you take it superficial value. It connects the dots in a way. It's a logical fallacy, basically, where it connects the dots in a way that makes sense if you don't think about it or drill into it. And if you are coming from the biased point of view that direct supervision, LINAC babysitting is required, and you come up with this argument, or somebody tells you this argument, you're probably going to run with it because it makes sense. And then to actually find, even if you say to yourself, like I did, well, how does teleradiology work? To find this, it requires looking at things and using keywords and stuff that you wouldn't, if you type in to Google radiation therapy, place of service or whatnot, this isn't going to come up. But anyway, I do suspect, it's half hope, half suspect, that this argument was put forward in good faith. I don't know, obviously. And so in case anyone is still confused, CMS themselves gave us this very helpful little example. Let's take a listen.
For example, a beneficiary receives an MRI at an outpatient hospital near his/her home. The hospital submits a claim that would correspond to the TC portion of the MRI. The physician furnishes the PC portion of the beneficiary's MRI from their office location. Therefore, POS code 22 shall be used on the physician's claim for the PC to indicate that the beneficiary received the face-to-face portion of the MRI, the TC, at the outpatient hospital.
Obviously, I find that little example makes this whole thing quite clear. And just to clarify those abbreviations, so PC is professional component, TC is technical component, and POS is place of service. And so this exactly covers this concern that is raised by this agency where supervision is not the same as physician work. It's a good point. And they're saying that you are not allowed to bill for professional service that remotely if it doesn't have a telehealth code.
Not really.
And clearly other specialties, I assume this came up from early days or not early days, but the teleradiology times. And because this transmittal came out in 2013, just reflecting back on this whole story for us with supervision and knowing that 2008, 2009 was CARES Act, FCA, beef up, crackdown. It tracks that other specialties were also having trouble sorting out codes and whatnot. All in all, reflecting on the arguments that are basically immaterial because of direct virtual supervision, but we have IT, diagnostic test, professional societies claim it is. I would argue it's pretty clear from the Medicare policy benefits manual that it is clearly not. And then this bizarre unilateral place of service argument. Now, again, I've only seen this put forward by this one agency, but claiming that you can't, I sometimes just laugh. And I can't get through this with a straight face, but claiming that you are not allowed to do the professional work from a different place if it's not a telehealth code. It was a valiant effort. I get it. And again, obviously I'm biased in a certain direction as well. In my opinion, in my bias, I'm just trying to read the regulations as CMS is putting them out, and I'm not approaching this with a certain agenda other than my agenda that I think this is wrong or what other people have put out is wrong. I think it's pretty clear what CMS is trying to do here. And in that spirit, we have two whistleblower cases that illustrate the point. And so people would be reminded by me to notice that there really hasn't been too many of these cases lately. And that's on purpose. And so there was that run of these supervision whistleblower cases with the radiation oncology back after the CARES Act. So starting with Todd's Mima case in 2008, 2009, all in that paper, Target Tumors Not Yourself, that was the subject of the last episode, that was published in 2015. So you had this 7-8 year run where this was pretty common, and then they start to slow. And there's a couple reasons for that. And a big one, and this is hearsay or gossip, or I don't know, this isn't written anywhere, but I've talked to lawyers in this space, in the whistleblower QTM space, like the important ones, not just my Uncle Saul down the street, the big firms. And what I was told is that the government just got sick of this, where if they can't get $100 million out of it, which they really can't, because with all these bundlings and all these things, like the money in these things is not what it used to be, which obviously, as cold as that sounds, it's, as we covered in the last episode, or it's what FCA is supposed to be about. It's how the government's recouping money. And it's, well, we think of it as safety, or at least that's the argument that springs up around this. On the government side, it's usually to combat abuse and waste, and it's not about safety. And then these cases are a drop in the bucket for the most part, and there's no clear slam dunk. Now, certainly in some of these other cases, if you came in and you had this case where this physician was grossly negligent and just doing insane things, that's an entirely different, but then you're wandering into malpractice territory. And that's the key for the sweet spot, as is a weird way to call it. But in these cases, a case that's great for the False Claims Act that the government would jump on board with would be some clear-cut fraud, abuse, waste that could recover tens of millions of dollars. That's the ideal for the False Claims Act. And because it's not necessarily about because it's not necessarily about safety, the supervision fraud and abuse cases, they just lost their luster when things were bundled and whatnot. And to get the government interested now, they'd have to be pretty sensational, because it's pretty, you're not going to get a supervision case that's worth $100 million anymore. And if it was so sensational, so over the top that there's some gross negligence sort of thing, then the FCA, the False Claims Act case would probably be a part of it, but it would be more in the territory of just malpractice to the point of manslaughter or those sorts of things. That's why we haven't heard about these types of cases, because the government's just not interested in them. And to illustrate my point here, I've got this first one I talked about on, it was then Twitter, now X, it was before that takeover. But so this came out in 2022, and it's with the University of Maryland Shore Regional Health. and the DOJ. You can Google these things. The Department of Justice actually has their own press releases about these. But so DOJ has this out. But Maryland agreed to pay a whopping $296,870 to settle false claims allegations over radiation therapy and diagnostic services provided without direct physician supervision. And this, in my opinion, time will prove me right or wrong, but in my opinion, this is the last time that we're going to see this. So it was filed by a whistleblower named John Philip Sawyer, who was employed from 2007 through 2018 as lead physicist and radiation safety officer at Shore. And I'm reading off a compliance blog here, but because that's what I do with my life. According to the FCA settlement, DOJ alleged Shore billed Medicare for radiation therapy services from January 16th, 2014 through July 5th, 2018 without the requisite physician supervision. And now remember, I'm not writing, this is not coming from me. I'm pulling this. This blog is from Cosmos, which is some company that focuses on compliance. In this blog post, they write, at the time, Medicare covered radiation therapy and diagnostic services in an outpatient setting under a physician's direct supervision, which means the physician is immediately available to render assistance and directions throughout the performance of the procedure. The DOJ alleged that Shore's Cancer Center only had one physician available to supervise radiation therapy during that period, and on many occasions, the physician allegedly, quote-unquote, was performing uninterruptible radiation oncology services at a separate location, the Shore Health Medical Pavilion at Easton, while unsupervised radiation therapy and diagnostic services were being performed at the Cancer Center. And Shore submitted claims to the Medicare program for these unsupervised radiation therapy and diagnostic services performed at the Cancer Center, the settlement said. And so here's my favorite part. While DOJ's investigation of Shore focused on the direct physician supervision requirement for certain radiation therapy treatments that required immediate availability during the procedure, CMS in January 2020 relaxed the supervision requirements for radiation therapy. A spokesperson for the University of Maryland Shore Regional Health told this company, CMS shifted from direct to general supervision, which, quote unquote, does not require the physician to be immediately available, said the spokesperson, Michael Schwartzberg. The settlement is for a modest sum of money and doesn't signal the government is interested in aggressively pursuing direct supervision cases, said attorney Brian Feldman, who is with this firm, Harder, Seacrest, and Emery LLP. The carefully constructed language in the settlement is reminding the world that they do not require the doctor to be present in the room when the procedure is performed to meet direct supervision. The government doesn't say we will claim a violation every time you weren't present, Feldman noted. DOJ also seems to be saying the physician must be in uninterruptible at a separate location to cross the FCA threshold, which is quite interesting because this has been the concern of over everyone. In this whole hard line in the sand that certain professional societies have drawn and private entities, they are wielding this belief about direct supervision to essentially prohibit remote work, or basically remote work as their main thing. And because historically, immediate and uninterruptible has never been really defined, many, many radiation oncologists over the last 10 years, 15 years, have brought up things like, what if I'm in a tumor board across campus? And that's the crazy thing. A lot of these sprawling urban academic medical centers, you'll be a block or two away sometimes, depending on the structure of the institution. And if there's no line there, and this case proved it. So this is very interesting for two points, because again, FCA sets, this is our version of precedent. So because this isn't a speed limit, it's not going to be like criminal proceeding setting precedent. These FCA whistleblower cases are what sets our precedent. And this is everything. So let's say COVID didn't happen, pandemic didn't happen, we didn't have direct virtual supervision. This is my point that I've been making since November 1st, 2019, where the rule changed, the regulations changed. It's very clear to this attorney, the spokesperson, the University of Maryland. And further, government's not really interested in doing this anymore. So when this got brought up on X, there was a person at an agency who used this as an example for why I was wrong about general supervision. But it's key. It's the alleged events were in 2014 to 2016 or whatever. It was before 2020. It's just that the case finally finished in 2022. And that's part of why the government is just not interested in these things anymore. You're not. So I don't know when the whistleblower stuff, when it was brought, But you're talking about years of work for a settlement of slightly less than $300,000. And I'm almost certain that sum of money doesn't even cover the electricity, plumbing, and office supply costs that it cost to try this case. But that brings me to the big case, the one that answers a lot of questions in terms of setting precedent in the legal record. I have not seen other folks talk about this. It's obviously, all of this is public record, so I'm not doing anything tricky. I just know how to get these things and so on and so forth. But unlike the Maryland case, I haven't seen any sort of real press releases, or I don't even remember, honestly, how I found this. I think this was going back to when I was doing the 21C stuff where I don't remember. It was pure luck. All of this is just pure luck. And by that, I read LexisNexis until my eyes bleed. But I am also not interested, as I've been trying to do, for not naming certain things or trying to use names and whatnot as little as possible, because I'm really not interested in just dragging things through the mud for the sake of doing it. I'm going to try to minimize my use of the named parties involved just because I can. But if people want to go look this up, there is some stuff that's up on the Googles that you don't need to know how to access Pacer or LexisNexis or anything. It is out of Kentucky, and it is civil action number 16-DLB-EBA, and it's Radiation Therapy Services PSC. We'll pick it up. So that should be enough. Anyone can go find this. This case was brought in. There's so many interesting things about this, whereas I found the Maryland case pretty clear cut, where while it was settled after the general supervision switch, the period of interest was clearly before 2014 to 2018. This was in a period of before the switch, and it was decided after. It doesn't really rely on that. And I believe that is because this is technically all done in freestanding. So this is another thing where it's not entirely clear to me what billing rules were being invoked. I'm pretty sure, based on how this case is argued, that it's freestanding and thus would make sense that they wouldn't try to pull the general supervision argument, but your guess is as good as mine. It's confusing, and actually as such, just everything about this particular case illustrates how confusing all of this is. It's if I could have a wish and say, dear magical Gandalf of the courts, please give me a case that talks about all the confusing things in radiation medicine so we can have precedent, and this would be the case. I don't get it, but thank you, legal Gandalf, and I used my wish on this. But so the case was brought by a radiation oncologist. It's a QTM whistleblower case. He worked at, the person who is the whistleblower, I'm just going to call Relator, and the practice he whistleblew on, I'm just either going to say defense or defendants, and just because it makes me feel better to do that. But so the Relator is a radiation oncologist, worked at the practice of the defense from July 2012 through October 2015. And he brought the lawsuit on December 7th, 2016. So this is broken up into, I think, at least five counts. And I'm only going to talk about the last counts have to do with this chemotherapy thing, which I'm just going to ignore because it's not relevant, but also will be here forever. Anyway, so count one alleges that from July 2012 until at least October 2015, defense presented false claims for reimbursement that certified either expressly or by implication that Relator provided or supervised the radiation oncology services billed when, in fact, the Relator did not provide or supervise the services, which were also not delegated to a physician qualified to perform the radiation oncology services. Count one also alleges that defense falsely certified that a physician qualified to perform radiation oncology services reviewed and approved guidance images produced prior to each daily treatment within 24 hours or prior to the next treatment delivery. Just to pause there for plain language summary. So this is a little bit confusing how they word this, where it's specifically stating that in this case, there were claims submitted under the Relator's name for things that were not being directly supervised by the Relator or by a radiation oncologist, and in essence saying supervision rules weren't followed. And that requires clarification because of the count three. But so one, no supervised, no directly supervised stuff. Two, it was not delegated to a radiation oncologist. Now, that's key because it's not saying that there was no doctor, no physician supervising, just not a radiation oncologist. And also interesting, the second part of this was that the IGRT was not approved within 24 hours or prior to the next treatment. See what I said about this case? Just wait. It gets even better. So count three alleges that defense submitted fraudulent claims insofar as the claims falsely certified, either expressly or by implication, that a particular named physician, relator, or another doctor of the practice performed certain radiation services when that named physician did not provide the services, did not supervise the services, and was not on the premises or otherwise available at the facility when the services were rendered. And that is the ever omnipresent concern about, if I go on vacation, does the doctor covering for me bill under their name or my name? And same with doc of the day. If there's a doc of the day system, are you billing it under the doc of the day who's approving images or under the attending physician in charge of the case? I know practices everywhere fight about this constantly. So buckle up, and because that's addressed here too. And then count five is about chemo, which we're going to skip. And count six alleges that defendants submitted fraudulent claims related to simulation procedures, as the claims falsely represented by implication that the treating physician prepared a record of the simulation procedure and signed or initialed the record of the procedure, that defendants maintained the required documentation of simulation procedures, and that a radiation oncologist had performed the simulations. And this is where it's confusing. Again, all of this is confusing. This case was initiated in December of 2016, and I would argue it's still technically ongoing, meaning a couple things. One, the first opinion, so actually the document I'm reading, the result, as it were, the opinion of the court, was published or was rendered in October of 2020. Yeah, October 20th, 2020. Then there have subsequently been appeals, and I believe they're on appeal number three. So there's a total of four or five of these things of court opinions, which is how this normally goes. So basically the lawsuit, then the court rendered an opinion, and then the relator appealed, and the court rendered an opinion again, and the relator appealed, and the court rendered an opinion again, and the relator appealed, which is what brings us to today. So the most recent opinion by the court, and it's just, these is how these go. So the most recent opinion by the court was done about a year ago, and we'll get there. But I'm going to... So in any of my narration here or my reading of it, I'm just paraphrasing. And if people want the gritty details, they should go get the documentations because it's a lot, but we'll be here forever. In the court's opinion, the section A, performance by radiation oncologist. And it starts with, the court will first address defendant's argument that because radiation services are purely technical, they need not be provided by a physician, let alone by a physician qualified to perform radiation oncology services. And this goes on to, this is why I brought up the Incident 2 stuff in the very first episode. So we're covering two things here about Incident 2 billing, or in this concept of supervision, did we forget about our radiation therapist, and does that all count? The core of the argument that they made was that, citing various Medicare manuals and policies and whatnot, they argue that Medicare regulations demonstrate that technical staff, rather than physicians, perform radiation services, albeit under the supervision of a physician. Thus, according to defense, relator's claims that they violated the FCA by falsely certifying that relator or another radiation oncologist performing certain radiation services fails as a matter of law because physician performance is not required. Yet the amended complaint identifies allegedly false claims for radiation oncology services that appear to correspond specifically to physician services, as opposed to services performed by technical staff. For example, relator alleges that defendants improperly billed for services falling outside the range labeled as technical, and specifically the court references 77401 through 77416. Just to interject, and I probably should have said this up top, but my impression of what was happening here is that the practice consisted of at least two radiation oncologists, and I can't quite tell, but I think it's at least two medical oncologists, but I think that's what was staffing the department at all times, was that there is at least one doctor in the building whenever patients were being treated, but they would not all be there simultaneously. And so the crux of this is that it sounds like sometimes the medical oncologist was supervising in the spirit of direct, meaning there is a physician that was immediately available, and or vice versa, which is the chemo stuff we're skipping, in that there was only a radiation oncologist in the building when patients were being given chemo. That's my read of this. That's not, might be spelled out, but I can't read 10,000 documents all the time. Then the relator bringing the suit is basically saying several things. Of one, by doing it this way, by having periods of time when there was a med onc, just only a med onc in the building, radiation patients were being treated, and then the bills are being submitted, I presume, under the name of the attending physician, the attending radiation physician. And that's why this is so interesting and what I think is going on here. And then even more interesting is what the argument is being, basically the defense is arguing against. It's like when I say, do we know that time is linear, is just a construct? They're just attacking, or their argument is built on reality itself, which is an interesting tack. But it was a great idea because given the time, this is still the height of the Cold War, as it were, of supervision. But I'm going to skip ahead here and get to this is where the court renders its opinion about this particular thing. Defendant's argument that radiation services in general are purely technical in nature is not responsive to relator's specific allegations. Furthermore, defendants do not argue that, assuming some radiation services at issue require physician performance, that physician needs not be a radiation oncologist. In other words, defendants have not challenged relator's assertion that certain services were required to have been performed by a physician who was specifically qualified to perform radiation oncology services, instead focusing on the issue of whether Medicare regulations require performance by a physician for radiation services at all. Accordingly, relator's amended complaint survives to the extent it alleges defendants falsely certified certain radiation oncology services, denoting physician performance, were performed by relator or another radiation oncologist. And this is why they can scare us with whistleblower stuff, because that is confusing, and there's a lot going on here. And if the defense had hired a different attorney, what argument would have been made then? And it's cliche to say, but really, it's not necessarily about right or wrong. Certainly in these things, like there's no safety issue in this case, which is the key difference between all of it, is that there's no sensational story about a patient coding or some weird theft or embezzlement, or it's literally, this case is trying a situation that I'm sure is actually fairly common in this country, maybe not spoken about, but where you've got a couple rad oncs, a couple med oncs, the med oncs are around when providing direct supervision, when maybe the rad oncs aren't, and vice versa. And they got a doc of the day system or whatnot. And so they're billing under it. It sounds like what is going on here is that all of the treatment courses were just being billed under the attending rad onc. So if Dr. A started a patient on treatment, Dr. B started other patients, but on a random Wednesday when only Dr. A is around, at the end of the day, the bills are still being submitted between Dr. A and Dr. B. And so I just can't even imagine how common this probably is. And it's a bold move to try to bring this as a whistleblower case, and bold move that the government even agreed to it, which is, maybe this was the nail in the coffin case. But so anyway, part B here is supervision by a radiation oncologist. Unlike his allegations related to the provision of radiation oncology services, relator's allegation that defendants falsely certified that certain radiation services were supervised by a relator or another radiation oncologist fails because a relator has not identified a regulation of statute requiring that a radiation oncologist, as opposed to another type of physician, supervise the services. And skipping ahead here, while relator correctly asserts and defendants concede that the Medicare Benefit Policy Manual requires direct supervision by a physician of radiation oncology services, the policy does not require that the supervising physician be a radiation oncologist in particular. And of note, this has only been bandied about a bit. This has not been a policy stance by professional societies or companies. This has just been one of the theoretical boogeymen that has been brought up, but the court correctly identifies that is not said anywhere. And so then we're going on to simulation services. Relator's false presentation claim regarding simulation services similarly fails to the extent relator alleges that such services must be performed by a radiation oncologist as Relator does not provide any legal basis for that contention. But I'm sure how many of you guys have been in this situation? All right, we're gonna go up to named physician claims. So the intent of this series is obviously not, this is just a happy accident. And I'm only including it here because I know this comes up an awful lot. I've heard this comes up a lot. We're just going to leave it like that. So for the named physician claims, defendants also seek dismissal of Relator's named physician claims, wherein Relator alleges that defendants submitted false claims or records certifying that a certain named physician performed or supervised radiation services, when in reality, that named physician did not perform or supervise those services. Why don't we go ahead and switch to a different AI narrator for pieces of this court's opinion? We need to come up with a name for this one, but take it away.
Defense also seek dismissal of Relator's named physician claims, wherein Relator alleges that defense submitted false claims or records certifying that a certain named physician performed or supervised radiation services, when in reality, that named physician did not perform or supervise those services. These claims are distinct from other counts addressed above, wherein Relator alleges that defendants falsely certified Relator performed or supervised radiation or simulation services when in fact no radiation oncologist performed or supervised those services. By contrast, these counts merely allege that the particular physician listed on the claim form did not perform or supervise the service. Defense argues that even assuming they listed the wrong physician, the physician who did not actually perform or supervise the service, on the form submitted to Medicare and other government programs for reimbursement, such a clerical error would not be material to payment of the claim. The court agrees.
This is also great to bring up, and even, I don't think I had heard this before, but in terms of how we as physicians perceive what whistleblower claims, I feel like, and maybe again, this is just me, maybe you guys figured it out. Whenever we talk about whistleblower cases, I always assume like somebody's getting hurt or something unsafe is happening, just something bad is happening. And in reality, I have learned, the one thing I've learned over the past 5, 6, 7 years, however long I've been looking at this stuff, is that is not actually what the government cares about. Again, it's that line of you're looking for fraud and abuse or whatnot, but if it's like unsafe and dangerous, and not that these cases don't have a flavor of that, they're just usually more. And so this argument here, and this you can extrapolate as to the implications of this, in terms of trying to invoke a false claims case or a successful action, the question that the government is answering is, all right, no one is denying in this case that the bill was submitted under one physician's name, but the services were performed by another physician. But at the end of the day, it did not affect whether or not the government was going to pay the bill. So the claim is, this count is dismissed, which is the correct thing to do. But then it goes against anything that we've always thought about. But that's what the government cares about. It's, look, your practice submitted a bill for these services, and then we're being told that, oh, the Dr. A and B are both part of this practice. It was Dr. A that clicked approve on those IGRT images, but it was Dr. B whose name was submitted with that. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. The services were performed. Everything else is appropriate. So the name on the bill did not materially affect the who's going to pay the claim. But anyway, you can run with that in terms of what that means. But let's continue on.
Thus, while Relator alleges that the particular physician named on certain claims did not actually supervise those services, whether the particular named physician was actually the physician who supervised the service would not impact Medicare's obligation to pay for the services, so long as they were directly supervised by a physician. Because Relator does not allege that the identified services were not supervised by any physician, he has failed to allege a material violation of the FCA. See United States versus Eeyore Institute of Chicago, finding materiality lacking where defendant listed the wrong provider identification number because the error did not change Medicare's obligation to pay the claims. Perhaps realizing the deficiency in these counts, Relator, in his response brief, suggests that the court should construe these counts as alleging that no physician provided or supervised the services at issue. But the amended complaint could not be clearer that the claims and records at issue in these counts were allegedly false because the particular physician, or named physician, did not provide or supervise the services.
So now the final part that I'm going to include from this section is pretty interesting, and this is where things get spicy. And I really like it because it's clearly the judge is not happy with what the relators team was trying to do with this. And then it just, I'm also including this to show that there's so many nuances and flavors to these things. So if you guys ever have somebody showing up, a consultant or billing person, whatever, and says, this is the way it is or else, nothing is that black and white, because then you got to follow that train of logic all the way to the station here. Enjoy.
Moreover, based on the allegations in the amended complaint, it cannot be reasonably inferred no other physician supervised the procedures in question in lieu of the named physician. At least two physicians worked at the cancer centers, and the amended complaint indicates that a third doctor also worked at the cancer centers beginning in August 2014. Even assuming there were only two possible physicians who could have supervised the services, one being the relator himself, it does not reasonably follow that if one did not supervise, then the other did not either. Further, relator may not now effectively amend his complaint through his brief in order to allege an entirely different theory of liability. He also cannot rely on additional allegations in his brief to supplement or clarify the allegations in the complaint. Accordingly, accepting as true relator's allegation that defense billed under the names of particular physicians who did not actually perform or supervise certain radiation services, and drawing all reasonable inferences in relator's favor, counts 3 and 4 fail to allege that defense materially violated physician supervision requirements. Thus, motion to dismiss is granted.
And looking at the clock here, what I'm going to do is skip ahead a bit in a way to make this concise. Otherwise, we will be here for 17 hours, which again, trying not to do. What I'm going to do is read how the original court opinion goes, and this is in October of 2020, and then we're going to just revisit the most recent appeal. So the most recent court opinion on the appeal was from a year ago, and just know that in between, this is ping pong back and forth, but you'll get a flavor for what we're thinking about and why. The point of this episode is just to arm yourself with information and knowledge for when you have a billing person says that you got to do something, or when somebody shows up and gives a talk and tells you if you do XYZ, it's going to be fraud. And the point is always ask why. Just always ask why. Because my opinion on these things, it's just my opinion, and it's not setting precedent. And even if I go into a court of law, somebody brings a case against me, it depends on the error. So I will have a different argument based on the lawyers I have. And even if you do hold everything else the same, it's still me, same situation, but then you put a different lawyer and it would sound different. It would go different. It would depend on the judge. It would depend on the state. And then it would very crucially depend on time. Because again, as we have seen, when things are changing. So the Maryland case is a perfect example of the settlement was reached after the rule change, which was referenced in the press release. But the allegations were from an era when it was a different rule. And just always ask why and be on the lookout. But so in the final section of the original opinion, section E, dismissal with prejudice. Defendants request that the court dismiss relator's amended complaint with prejudice. Defendants specifically assert that dismissal with prejudice is appropriate because relator's entire case is based upon a mischaracterization of the prerequisite conditions of payments for the services encompassed in this litigation. In response, relator requests generally leave to amend should one or more counts be deemed deficient. The court agrees that, with respect to counts 1 and 2, relator has demonstrated no basis in law for a requirement that certain radiation oncology services be supervised by a radiation oncologist. Accordingly, counts 1 and 2 will be dismissed with prejudice to the extent relator alleges that defendants falsely certified that certain radiation oncology services were supervised by a qualified radiation oncologist. Relator has similarly failed to show a legal basis for his claim, alleged under count 7, that defendants falsely certified by implication that certain simulation services were performed by a radiation oncologist. Thus, count 7 is dismissed with prejudice to the extent relator alleges these simulation services required performance by a radiation oncologist. At this time, relator has not adequately pleaded that the radiation services and chemotherapy services identified in counts 3 through 6 were not supervised by a physician, alleging instead that a particular physician did not supervise the services. Yet, the parties agree that radiation oncology services and Incident 2 services require some level of physician supervision. Moreover, in his response brief, Relator indicates that he intended to allege that no physician supervised these services because it appears that with greater factual detail, Relator may be able to state a claim for relief. Counts 3 through 6 will be dismissed without prejudice. Now, and to my non-legal self, that means that they can appeal. And basically, that's how these things go, right? There's eight total counts. And 8 is this conspiracy claim, which, again, well, it's not a point of the supervision episode, obviously, but there's 8 different claims in this. And this is incredibly complex. And this is how it always goes. And it's always painted so black and white. But so let's go ahead and fast forward to the salient parts of the most recent opinion, several appeals later, on these items of interest. So let's take it away.
To counter Relator's assertion, defense cites an American Society of Radiation Oncology article that discusses the various roles and requirements of a radiology practice, such as defense. In his response, Relator answers that defense billed for both professional and technical components of services, but that no qualified physician provided the professional component. Relator seemingly posits that the professional component must be conducted by a radiologist or a radiation oncologist. As pointed out by defense, the Medicare Claims Processing Manual provides that claims must be paid for professional components of services furnished by a physician to an individual patient in all settings under the fee schedule, regardless of the specialty of the physician who performs the service. The court agrees that Relator has failed to establish that the specific services had to be performed by a radiation oncologist instead of any physician. Moreover, defense is correct that this court's 2020 order rejected the idea that a radiation oncologist had to perform the relevant services instead of any physician, regardless of specialty. Second, Relator does not address the defense argument regarding ASTRO's guidance on review of images and provides no sources to the contrary. Indeed, ASTRO's guidance indicates that it is recommended that patient charts and images should be reviewed weekly, not that it is required prior to every treatment. Since Relator's argument has been rejected previously by the court, and he has still failed to allege that the lack of a radiation oncologist's performance of services is a material precondition of payment, counts 1 and 2 are hereby dismissed.
Now, that last part even surprised me of the 24-hour thing. And so this is a good example of how my own personal opinion is on this. The intent of offline review of IGRT is to note any sort of extreme variance that perhaps your therapist did not see. And I do think there is value in terms of the safety of approving the images prior to the next fraction. And that is an excellent sort of example of safety versus fraud, basically, where the court doesn't have a problem dismissing that, saying, no, that's shenanigans. Now, us as physicians, we know, or at least to be again clear, my interpretation of IGRT and offline review and doing it within 24 hours or at least prior to the next fraction is a safety one. But interesting to see this, did not expect that. Let's move on.
Count 3 alleges that defense submitted claims that certified physicians were present in the facilities where the services were rendered when they were actually not present. Count 4 pleads a related false statement claim based upon the same allegations as Count 3. At the heart of these allegations is the claim that no physician provided the services described in the billing codes, no physician supervised the provision of the services, and no physician was on the premises at the time. Unfortunately for Relator, he fails to provide any relevant regulations or federal law that support his argument. Instead, he simply alleges that these false statements were material and preconditions of payment from the Medicare and Medicaid programs. Relator has been given several opportunities to amend his complaint, so the court will not accept bare-bones assertions as adequate to state a claim. Moreover, defense argues that the only 2 codes listed in these counts with professional components need not be performed on the premises, since they require the interpretation of radiological procedures. Relator offers no response to these arguments. Relator has likewise waived his opposition to dismissal of these counts by failing to respond to defense's argument. Accordingly, counts 3 and 4 are dismissed.
So this is actually, again, bringing up the point from earlier when Astro was claiming that IGRT was a diagnostic test. And so it was used successfully. So the key language here that I find interesting is that they don't call it a diagnostic. Merely, it's the defense argues that only 2 codes listed in these counts with professional components need not be performed on the premises, since they require the interpretation of radiological procedures. Relator offers no response to these arguments. And then the court finds with the defense. I mean, that is hilarious. This was all just coincidental, where it's notable that the court does not use the word diagnostic test. It just says radiological procedures, which kind of speaks against the earlier argument about IGRT is diagnostic, and then also speaks against the other place of service code argument that a private agency has put forth in other works. And so that's where the case stands currently. I'm curious to see what will be appealed next, because this has been dragged out. So this was initiated in 2016. It is now almost 2024, and I'm kind of surprised they're still going with this, or the relator is still going with this, but maybe I wasn't there. I don't know. Maybe there's something else going on, but I'm going to end it here. So to recap, in terms of the modern era, and there's probably going to be an episode 4, because I didn't even really get into the virtual direct supervision or the new Palmetto Mac update with defining immediate as 1 to 2 minutes, which is lunacy, but that'll maybe be episode 4 or something. So when the general supervision switch came, they trotted out, they being professional societies, the argument that somehow IGRT is now magically a diagnostic test that has never been used before. Just because it uses x-rays does not make it a diagnostic test. If you also read the same Medicare benefits policy manual that they reference, just go up a little bit, and it is not a diagnostic test. Then, because that didn't really work after the PHE and virtual direct supervision, a different agency as a scare tactic has come out with the place of service argument, where you can't bill the professional component for a code that is not a telehealth code, which negates a lot of other things of medicine. And so not only was that already addressed in a transmittal 10 years ago, this particular court opinion also says that that's not a thing. And then finally, all of this is moot. So again, I believe this big case here was in a freestanding. So this isn't a freestanding even. This isn't even trying to invoke general supervision. Could be wrong about that, but that's my read of this. And then in freestanding, we have general when we have virtual direct. And I think to me, at this point, the supervision question is pretty clear. And at the end of the day, we're all really beholden to the politics of our departments. It's when you got billing and compliance breathing down your neck, and the only thing they've got is opinions from professional societies or private companies that profit off of this. If you're going to successfully argue against history, against dogma, you got to know your stuff. And obviously, I'm not a lawyer. These are just my reads, and these are probably going to change. But this is a good illustration of how nuanced these things can be and the importance of just asking why. And if somebody tells you something is wrong, just ask why. And if all these vague threats of whistleblowing and all things, it's just there's so much to this, but there's not Medicare police. It's just opinions. And very curious to see how this all plays out over the next few years here. And I assume that a lot of virtual direct stuff is going to be made permanent, and Medicare is just, or CMS is trying to punt that decision probably to a new administration. It's pretty interesting how they just keep deferring. We've been doing this now for 4 years and they just keep deferring, but whatever. The takeup is this: target tumor is not yourself, but paranoia is not good for patient care. There is no medicine police. Always ask why.
This has been a Photon Media production. Don't forget to like and subscribe on whatever platform you use to listen to us. Be well and be mom.